You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 24th of March 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show,
London is the greatest city in the world, and we stand together in the face of those who seek to harm us and destroy our way of life. We always have, and we always will. Londoners will never be cowed by terrorism.
London's Mayor Sadiq Khan says all the stuff you'd expect London's mayor to say following Wednesday's apparent terrorist attack at Westminster. But is it still the right response? My guests Andrew Tuck, Carlotta Rebello and Chris Lord will be here to discuss that and the day's other top stories, including former Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak is free. Will we ever be able to say the same for his country? Reasons to wish the EU a happy 60th birthday and Donald Trump creating a surge in business. Mostly for people who can't stand him. We'll find out why now is the time to buy shares in art supplies. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to the show. My guests today are Andrew Tuck, editor of Monocle, Chris Lord, Istanbul bureau chief for Monocle, and Carlotta Rebello, producer for Monocle 24. Welcome all. And we will start tonight here in London. Having identified the perpetrator of Wednesday's apparent terrorist attack at Westminster, police, media, and public alike are now attempting to identify his motives. Khalid Masood, a 52-year-old British man born Adrian Elms, killed four people when he drove a pedestrian car at pedestrians on Westminster Bridge and stabbed a police officer guarding the Houses of Parliament. Andrew, first of all, as far as we can tell so far, are we looking at a sort of ruthless criminal terrorist mastermind or yet another delusional loser who seems to have been attracted for some reason or another to jihad?
Well, here we have a gentleman who started off his life as Adrian Elms, who converted to Islam and with all the passion of the convert has taken on his new religion as a zealot. And he has obviously found in faith something which corrected or filled in some gaps that he missed in his own life. Now, too often it is these people who seem to be the extremists who probably didn't grow up in a Muslim family, don't understand the faith in the way that many Muslims do. I think the guy is a bit of a loner. We've seen some attempts today for claiming this attack as being the work of Islamic State, but that seems very unlikely. Even by the methods he chose to kill, we have the feeling of him being a bit of a loner. So he chose a car and a sharp knife, you know, things that most of us have in our kitchen drawer or at our homes. Now, that strikes me as somebody who's a little bit outside the system. And we've seen a bit of a debate today as well about how we respond to this. I think, you know, that it's good to be concerned. It's good to be passionate about supporting the families of those affected by this. But at the end of the day, I think we do have to get on with life, not just in the sense of showing the terrorists it doesn't matter, almost because he doesn't matter. It was a terrible thing. Some people have tried to say, look, it's just the same as a car crash, and it kind of is, and I don't want to belittle it, but I do want to say this was a terrible, terrible incident, but it was that. It wasn't the Bataclan. It wasn't hundreds of people being killed. It wasn't like the IRA bombs of years gone by, which, you know, took out whole parts of the city. This was a terrible incident by an awful man, but we need to move on.
Carlotta, Andrew made the point there that Islamic State have claimed responsibility for this and said he was a soldier enlisted in their legions. And this has been duly reported, as I suppose it probably should be. But do the media need to start being a bit more sceptical about Islamic State's claims? Do we have to start basically saying to Islamic State, we'll prove it?
Well, in a way, it's easy to assume that Islamic State would claim any sort of attack when there's no way to corroborate that information. You know, saying that he was answering a calling of the caliphate is completely different than when we can trace it back to a network of Islamic State militants, and you can usually trace back the chatter in their own networks. And this is not the case. So I do think that as media, as people that are responsible to put that message out there, we need to be careful and kind of assess and dissect this information as we receive it.
Chris, what is your sense of how responses to this in the media and the wider world are evolving? Because we have had in London, I guess, if you look at the modern iteration of Islamist terrorism, we now have a history of this dating back to July 2005. And it strikes me that there is now a different tone in response. What I haven't heard any of following this attack, and what you hear increasingly little of, is the root causes argument. There was this reflex, even after the July 7th bombings in 2005, that this was somehow our fault, that we had brought this on ourselves. Like actual respectable newspapers published opinions to this effect. We don't hear any of that anymore, which you know, for my money at least, is a minor blessing.
I think that narrative has changed a bit, in as much as you're right. At one time, I think people, when they tried to understand, when it was a little bit, people were a little bit more naive about it, they tried to answer that question, why would somebody do this? And so therefore they look into things like, being marginalised in society, not feeling part of a sort of contemporary British society, or feeling somehow that their faith is not represented in that society, and so on. And I think as the years have gone by, I agree with you, I think that it has changed that narrative, whereby that's not quite as delved into anymore. I mean, I would probably argue that maybe some of the reason for that is because nowadays the image we have of jihadism and sort of Islamic terrorism, as it's now called, has become a lot more embodied in this image of something like Islamic State. For example, we now have a lot more of a clear, there's the enemy. Look, there is jihadism embodied in this sort of, quasi state of the caliphate. And I think back in 2005, that wasn't the case. People were simply going into psychology. Why would somebody do something like this? So I think that is probably the main thing that has evolved, really. And I think that, I actually still believe very much in that idea of root causes. You know, what are the root causes? It doesn't even have to be marginalised in society. What about things like cuts to mental health care? What about things like, engaging with people who are marginalised in society? We live in a society of...
Those are different root causes. The root causes people mentioned in 2005 and indeed in 2001 were more the more picturesque and dramatic geostrategic ones. But on that point, just finally on this one, Andrew, Chris mentions a sort of lack of mental health care, and I just wonder whether we make a mistake in characterising all such events as terrorism. It may have been in the mind of the perpetrator an attempt to commit a jihadist terror attack, but this reminds me, based on what we know so far, there's a difference in scale and a difference in, I guess, the importance of the location, but this is reminding me quite a lot of the attempted beheading of some poor commuter at Leytonstone tube station in late 2015, which clearly the person who carried it out believed he was participating in jihad, but was eventually revealed to be somebody with mental health issues and a drug problem.
Yeah, so I think that Chris has pointed out something that's interesting here. Potentially, who knows, potentially this guy did have a mental health issue. Potentially he's the kind of guy who 20 years ago would have ended up in a gang. I don't know. But I think the other interesting thing about this is there has been a rush almost on everyone. I agree, so we don't want to spend too much time dwelling on why these people do what they do. There is a firmer line about it now. But there is also, because of that, a prejudice, which concerns me. So in this instance, we have seen a picture of a woman in a veil, in a headscarf, walking across Westminster Bridge, and she's looking at her phone. Now, it turns out that she's posted today saying that she was looking at her phone in absolute terror. She was petrified. She wanted to tell her family she was safe. That picture was seen by many people online, and they judged that she was indifferent to the people dying on the pavement that she was walking past. The woman was in terror. I saw online, I don't know how it ended up on my feed, but on a feed that I look at, somebody posting within seconds of the attack.
It is amazing how fast people are.
Yeah. So to say, who supports the deporting of Muslim terrorists to their own country? Now, that is the perception already. Before we know who this guy is, there was a perception that he was a foreigner, that he was a bad person coming to our country, which was wrong. And even Channel 4 News, they saw black guy of a certain size who looked a bit like somebody who's a radical preacher we've had in this country, who's currently in jail. They put up his name saying that it was him. So there's a rush, you know, from media organisations to kind of not, you know, not people on the right, not crazies, just people who feel, oh God, we shouldn't have these people in our country. The rush to prejudge. So on my own behalf, I think I would be cautious to prejudge his mental health as well.
Which is fair enough. There is that, but I think it's especially exacerbated by social media. It's that rush to insist that whatever has just happened proves that you were right all along.
Completely, and people are looking in this instance for what they want to see. You know, it's an issue of immigration. It's an issue of otherness. It's the failure of, you know, moderate Muslims to control people in their community. This guy was not really in a community. And again, we've seen today that many Muslim organisations and charities have been raising money to give to the people who have been most badly affected. That should be the headline. But of course, it won't be. The response will be that it wasn't enough, that they had a single woman walking across a bridge, happened to look at her phone, who it turns out was in absolute terror.
Okay, well, let's look now at Egypt, where former President Hosni Mubarak is reacquainting himself with his home in the Cairo suburb of Heliopolis, having been freed after 6 years of detention. Mr. Mubarak was convicted in 2011 of complicity in the deaths of protesters whose demonstrations led to his overthrow, but was cleared by Egypt's appeals court earlier this year. Chris, first of all, just because the counterfactuals are always fun, would Egypt now, do we think, be noticeably worse off if the revolution had never really got off the ground and Mubarak was still president?
I mean, if we wanted to be very pessimistic about it, we could say right now Egypt's economy is in absolute tatters. And yes, there has been little bits of signs of positivity at the start of the year. But fundamentally, there are massive problems in that country with regards to the standards, the quality of life that people now have compared to the days before the revolution. I think the question of ultimately what you're asking is, should the revolution, if it hadn't have happened, would Egypt be in a better place, or would life be better in Egypt? I think, you know, it's very difficult to say because, you know, in many ways, the things that have happened, it's not been a straightforward revolution happens, the sort of 30-year dictator is toppled, and therefore the army comes back. In the midst of all that, you have this sort of strange flirtation with democracy, where a party gets into power and therefore the leader of that party then gets the death sentence ultimately upon them. I think, you know, just to give you one thing, when the whole Arab Spring was happening, I remember I went to Algeria for a story for Monocle, and I remember talking to people at that time about what, you know, what they thought about what was happening in Tunisia and what was happening in Egypt. And they all said, because Algeria had an Arab Spring in the 1980s. It had pro-democracy uprisings exactly of this style. And what happened in the aftermath was that when they had a democratic vote, the government stepped back in and pulled it away from an Islamist party. They stopped those elections, and that's what caused the civil war in Algeria. So lots and lots of people had very, very cautionary tales about that time. So my point is that, you know, it's very hard to say. I think what a lot of people will feel, that the outpouring of demonstration, of, you know, imagining a better Egypt, was very, very positive. But then the reality of what has happened in life since then is very, very upsetting.
Carlotta, there's a slightly depressing thought, isn't there? The idea that Mubarak, back at his home, feels somehow vindicated. And indeed, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi does at one remove. Because Mubarak's pitch to the West was essentially always, all right, I may be an awful, ruthless military dictator, but I'm better, or I'm better than what would replace me. And this was, of course, the same pitch made by tyrants all over the Middle East.
Yeah, but you need to remember that Mubarak, even though he was gone, the system that he had put in place wasn't. You know, this is a guy that was going to the court by helicopter, leaving the helicopter in sunglasses. That's not really the signal of someone who's, you know, enjoying, facing a prison sentence and actually repenting for his human rights abuses and his horrible crimes. You know, Mubarak's fall was meant to signal this wave of change in the Arab world, and his release today simply crushes any hope of that ever happening.
Andrew, I guess the one of the many weirdnesses of the Arab Spring is which countries toppled and which ones didn't. And what has struck me, and I was in, I think around the same time Chris was in Algeria, I was doing a story for Monocle in Morocco, which didn't really wobble significantly at all. And that, of course, was one of the monarchies. The monarchies all endured. It was only the republics and the dictators that fell.
Yeah, but what was interesting in the case of Morocco, that the king did act and let some steam out of the system.
He didn't
make huge changes, but he made changes enough. I think what's interesting about, you know, so we know that in many other countries where there wasn't actually a revolution, they did make some adjustments that were sensible and wise. And maybe even where it all began back in Tunisia, that the story I still have confidence may end up well there. Libya looks terrifyingly difficult at the moment. Egypt, Syria, of course. But just before revolution gets a bad name, maybe I could steal your job for a moment, because Carlos, you're the only person here at the table who comes from a country that has had a recent revolution in the 70s, the Carnation Revolution, and actually a revolution that people seem to love still talk about in a very positive way about the transformation. So for your parents' generation, is that revolution still something that seems, you know, an amazingly sweet moment?
Oh, of course. And I think it really helps in the case of Portugal, the fact that it was a peaceful revolution and that ideology and violence was not a part of it at all. It's not even saying just a small incident. And for example, where I come from Madeira, it took 2 days for the revolution to get there. For 2 days, mainland Portugal was free of the dictatorship, but the news hadn't arrived to the islands yet. So everyone was, because airlines were disrupted, so the newspaper didn't arrive. So how would you know? And the airwaves, the radio and TV was taken off air. And it's interesting to see how, when we look back at that, you know, a revolution that the prompt was the song used for Eurovision a couple of years ago. And the stories every year, whenever there's documentaries on the anniversary of the revolution on the 25th of April, you have soldiers that were part of that march towards Lisbon, saying that they were all sitting in their barracks, and when the song finished playing on the radio, they were all crying. These, the men that led our revolution, they were crying because they finally realized this is actually happening, because it only happened after a failed attempt a couple of years before. So
the revolutions can go well.
Can go well and can go peacefully, and we can look back at them fondly.
Okay, well, on that heartwarming note, we will take a short break. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Andrew Tuck, Chris Lord and Carlotta Ribello. Coming up next, it's a happy birthday of sorts to the EU.
Monocle has bureau around the world, in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, Istanbul, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Hong Kong, our bureau chief is James Chambers.
There's no such thing as an ordinary day in Hong Kong. On any one day, I may be interviewing a city mayor or having coffee with a hotelier or chatting with an interior designer and then trying out the latest bar or restaurant. And mixed in with all of this, there'll be some wacky or outrageous news coming out of China which deserves to be covered on the radio. So it's this variety that I really love about the job.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
You are back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Andrew Tuck, Carlotta Ribello and Chris Lord. Now, this weekend, the leaders of 27 of the European Union's 28 present member states will gather in Rome to celebrate the 60th birthday of the EU. Not attending will be the United Kingdom, which is expected to formally begin its process of departure next week. The UK's decision to leave the bloc has cast rather a pall over the anniversary, and that being the case, we thought it would be fun to attempt to be optimistic about the EU's future. I'm the only non-European at this table, I have just realised.
Welcome.
Thank you. But I'm saying I have my escape pod in the form of an Australian passport. Andrew, what does the EU have to look forward to? It has this seismic departure coming up, but what can it feel good about as it looks ahead?
I think the biggest thing it can look forward to is getting rid of a lot of boring, grumpy, destructive, annoying British people. I think that's the biggest thing they can look forward to. There will suddenly be a group of people, with lots of people who are pessimistic about the future, lots of people who are difficult, but actually the rump of people who have been, endlessly sticking a stick into the spokes will be the Brits, and they'll be gone. And finally, they can focus on Europe, a group of nations with shared borders, much more of a shared history than we had with much of Europe. I was recently at my aunt, who's gone into a care home, and we were clearing the house, and we found a magazine from 1971. And it was talking about the optimism for the future of Britain being part of the European Union. And even all the adverts were addressed at the hope of the future. And I remember at that time speaking to my dad about it. My dad had fought in a war, had come back to Britain and felt that the only way for people to live safely was to share and to compromise and to have some ideals that they could all tap into. And that was what was at the heart of the then, you know, the European Union. And I think that is what those countries will be able to tap back into. I think it's going to be difficult. There'll be banks that fail, and there'll be maybe someone will fall in and out of the euro. But that essence, that shared history, that shared value, Germany knows, France knows, Denmark knows, Italy knows what it is like to be invaded, to lose, and to see people, you know, dying because of fascists and Nazis. And I think that that will bind them in a way when we're gone, and we're not there pretending that, you know, Churchill's still in number 10. We'll be gone. We can get on with our own business. I don't know what it's going to look like, but I wish them all well. And the boring Brits who sit on the sidelines hoping and praying that it's all going to go wrong for them, well, bad luck. I don't think it will.
Chris, Andrew discusses there the EU's role in preventing war on the continent, which is always something the EU sells itself as having done. And that is obviously, in the context of Europe's broad history, no small change. 70 years, give or take, Yugoslavia without a major punch up on the continent is a big deal. But does the EU need a more positive, I guess, sense of mission as well as that? Because that's kind of taking credit for a negative, as it were, which is like, this is a thing we stopped from happening. Does the EU need to emphasise what it can make happen?
I mean, I think if you head east to places like the Czech Republic, or where I was quite recently in Estonia, and you talk to people there about what the EU means to them, you come away from
Indeed, you come
away from it thinking how amazing the project is, and how many people feel that by being part of that bloc, that their lives has improved, that democracy in their country has improved, that checks and balances on what politicians do in that country has improved. I mean, I spent some time in Brno last year in the Czech Republic, and everyone they spoke to there said, thank God that we're part of the European Union, because we used to be the crossroads of Europe before war, before communism. And the European Union has brought us back to being that. We can hear Portuguese voices on the streets again. We hear Germans on the streets again. This is a fundamentally good thing. So I think if anyone, you know, what Andrew's saying about getting rid of the, you know, moany Brits and the sort of people who are down on it, I think I agree. And I think if you head to the east, you can't help but drink deep from the idea that the European Union is an amazing thing.
The most EU flags I've ever seen flown anywhere are in Kosovo and in Albania, two countries which aren't even members of the EU, but that says quite a lot about their aspirations. Carlotta, should the EU still be attempting to be ambitious, though, in terms of its expansion? Because some of the domestic political turmoil in EU countries has been, whether it's been rooted in anything sensible or not, but nonetheless has been due to the expansion into the East, the movement of populations from East into the West. And the next candidate nations, or the present candidate nations, Albania, Macedonia, Serbia, Montenegro and Turkey, are not likely to stop that argument.
No, and I think the EU will always have its challenges, both domestically, internally, be it the euro crisis, or now as we're seeing the rise of populism, and externally, the refugee crisis, which is still ongoing, just slowly off our radar because of the deal with Turkey, but it's still ongoing. There's more aggression from Russia. There's the dangers from NATO and where the alliance stand. They're always going to have that problem, but that doesn't mean as a unit and as a bloc it should stop being ambitious. It has to know where to stop, but the truth is the US started, as we mentioned, as a peace project, and at that has been very successful. You know, it incorporated countries from the south that were former dictatorships, countries from the east that are former communist countries, nations. So that goal of ensuring peace in countries that had been at war for decades and decades, I think they should give themselves a happy birthday.
Okay, well, finally tonight, we'll look at the United States and the gathering economic and cultural phenomenon which might best be described as the Trump effect. This is the paradox by which the US president's wrathful bluster and incoherent bloviating continues to improve the fortunes of the people he most hates. Having single-handedly revivified America's liberal newspapers and civil society, Trump seems to be doing the same for art supplies. The immense demonstrations against him have caused an actual measurable run on cardboard, marker pens, glues, scissors, paints, and glitter. 6.5 million poster boards was sold in the US in January. I love this story. This has just made me happy every time it's happened, and we've all seen it. Every time he tweets at the New York Times that it's a failing pile of garbage, they put on another 20,000 subscribers. Every author in the world, I count myself among them, dreams of being hate-tweeted by Trump. It would be a lottery win. Andrew, what other industries might, can you imagine him doing a favour, if inadvertently?
Well, advertently and inadvertently, he's obviously helped anybody who builds pipes and pipelines. That they're kind of rather happy. And before we completely take the man down, I hope he's going to be good for people who build infrastructure. You know, you go to America and you arrive at JFK or Newark, and it's blooming complicated getting into the city. Let's hope he fixes those things he said. You know, he promised trillions. We don't know where it's going to come from. He promised trillions to fix the infrastructure, and that's potentially good. I was in New York last weekend and staying in a hotel but meters from the front door of Trump Tower. And there's a really funny thing. That like all these old guys who are there, like, every day, and they've made all these kind of like protest signs on the card buying those things, and they're just posing with tourists, hundreds of tourists waiting, you know, to have their picture taken with a protester, and they can like jeer at the Trump Tower. So
it's great. It's like those old punks on the King's Road with,
yeah,
their
exactly mobiles. I saw where some of that card and those felt tip pens were going.
Has anybody at this table, I'm wondering, ever made or carried a protest sign of any description?
I've never made. I have carried one. I was more of, actually at real protests, I was more of a shouter than a waver. But I was once a Bollywood extra. I was actually an extra in Bollywood once, and my role was to be a protester in a protest on the outskirts of Mumbai. And my sign said, "We will only move on the possibility of getting greater remuneration for our work." And that's so. It was,
when do we want
so
it now?
It wasn't the snappiest. Yeah, it wasn't the snappiest of protest signs.
Anybody else?
Just as a student against the rise of school fees at university in Coimbra.
But did you actually make...
I actually made a sign.
What did it say?
The translation is something as boring as "no fees, no." But
I bet that sounds nicer in Portuguese,
yeah,
though.
Kind of. We spent all night at the students' union creating these signs and making them, and then got on a night bus all the way to Lisbon to protest in front of the Ministry of Education. We weren't that successful, but hey...
Being a bit negative, I don't mind, you know, the odd placard. I don't know if anyone wants to carry them. Good luck to them. I don't really like their badges. You know, that's what I don't like. I don't like people who are trying to sum up their whole political view in like two words on a lapel pin. I was at university when everyone had like the two word kind of like down with, up with. I was never very sure about summarising the nuances of my political opinions.
You could have just worn a really big badge with more nuanced thought through manifesto. Yeah,
had
exactly.
It entirely embroidered on my back or something.
I mean, that's what T-shirts are for. Surely, yes. That's what you can get thousands.
You don't really
of
get those protest T-shirts though, Dan, do you?
I don't know. I didn't. I did go to the women's protest march here in London the week of the inauguration. I did not actually carry a banner, but I was walking in general proximity with people who were. I didn't really see any. It wasn't really T-shirt weather.
I've been on a couple of gay pride ones, but I think these days, you know, in fact, it amassed just outside our offices a couple of years ago, and I went to have a quick look while I was working, nipped out, and. I think the most likely sign you would carry these days was, you know, "I work for Deutsche Bank" or "I work for Google." The whole thing was like so corporate. I was amazed at the transformation of the event.
Well, on that note, we must all get down to the art supplies shop before they run out entirely. That is all we have time for. My thanks to Andrew Tuck, Carlotta Ribello and Chris Lord. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Anthea Longo. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. Music next at 1900. It's The Menu with Marcus Hippie, and there's more on the day's main stories on the daily at 2200. Midori House returns on Monday at 1800 London time. But for now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.